Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You win votes by being hard on crime. So you sacrifice the integrity of the nation for short-term gains, rather than try to resolve this through responding positively to things like the Uluru Statement, you know, the voice from the heart, where people have said, you know, understand the tyranny of our powerlessness.
Hello everyone and welcome to the show. You're with Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and you're on Australian Politics Live. And my guest in the studio this week sort of requires no introduction really. Pat Dodson's referred to routinely as the father of reconciliation in Australia. 30 years ago, he was a commissioner on the Aboriginal Deaths in Custody Inquiry. And these days, of course, he's in federal politics. He's a senator representing WA for the Australian Labor Party and has a shadow ministry in the Indigenous Affairs portfolio. So, or shadow assistant ministry, I don't know, I never get the terms right. Pat, what is it? You say.
Well, I'm the shadow assistant on reconciliation and constitutional recognition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So I've invited Pat into the studio for reasons I think that'll be obvious to most listeners. It's been a very big week in Indigenous relations with White Australia, and Pat had some very forceful things to say about it in the Senate this week.
Now's the time to stop the rot of First Nations dying in custody, being over-imprisoned, and their children being put into out-of-care home.
I want to start with just a general question, Pat. At the start of the week, our Guardian Essential poll, which we do at the moment every week, showed that Australians, a very strong majority of Australians, 80% thereabouts, believed that there was institutional racism in the US. They were very clear about that. But when you ask the question about whether or not there was institutional racism in Australia, then the sample was much more divided. It was sort of like 30-40, split 30-40. Why do you think that is?
Oh, well, I think Australians have tended to see themselves as having a fair relationship with Aboriginal people, First Nations peoples. And I think they find it a bit confronting that when there's objective analysis done or serious reporting and investigations done, that's not the case. And it's always been a conundrum that Australians think they don't need international observation, criticism or guidance in how to go about First Nations policies or affairs. If you recall, we were reticent about signing up to the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous People's Rights. We finally did that after, you know, some reflection. We still haven't taken that anywhere in terms of domesticating that into Australian law, because we have this sort of confidence that we can manage things in-house.
Mm-hmm.
We do it terribly, terribly badly, I must say, from a First Nations perspective, because as I reflect on not only the past history, but recent history, and the Royal Commission is a good indicator of at least one of those benchmarks from which I look back on Australia, then you've got to say that there are systemic patterns that we've got to link in our thinking. I'll say a little bit more about that later, and I think people aren't very good at that. I think people tend to just look in isolation. There's a protest on today. What's that mean? You know, another death in custody. What's that mean?
So they don't pull the whole picture together.
They don't know how to connect all the dots. But if you, as a First Nation person, you're constantly connecting the dots because you're interconnected to a lot of people, either by way of relationship or knowledge of those families, or by suffering certain, you know, similar sorts of disadvantaged situations, those things. So there's, and naturally, I think First Nations people look for the connectivity, because we connect to the land, we connect to the topography, we connect to the sky, we connect to people. We have a kinship structure that goes beyond our immediate biological people, you know. So connectivity is a foundational principle in our way of thinking and our attitudinal approach to life. I don't think that's the case for non-Indigenous people, unfortunately. For some cultures it is, but generally for the Anglo-Celtic descendants, I think they've lost a lot of that.
Okay. And I want to take you back to the Royal Commission, just because obviously the Black Lives Matter protests in Australia over this past weekend related to Indigenous deaths in custody. Just you might tell people in a tick what that inquiry was about, because obviously for 30 years ago, there'll be some people listening to this podcast who weren't born 30 years ago, let alone be across the detail of that inquiry. But we might start it. I'll just put something to you that Neil Mitchell, the Melbourne radio host, said on Thursday. He said that Black deaths in custody was a furphy, his word, because there have been fewer Indigenous people per head of prison population dying in custody than white people. Right. He sort of acknowledged, obviously, that there were higher Indigenous incarceration rates, but Black deaths in custody is a furphy because, you know, not so many Black people dying. Now, I just put that as an opening for the Royal Commission and explaining to people what you discovered in that process of inquiry. You can respond to that, obviously, however you like.
Well, there is a correlationship between the levels of incarceration and the levels of deaths. And Aboriginal people do die disproportionately in custody for the numbers of incarcerations. But they don't die disproportionately to the major prison population. So the key matter in the Royal Commission was to, and the people who might recall, there was one commissioner initially, Mr Justice Muirhead, and then he found that, and that was primarily focused on rerunning coronial inquiries. What happened on the occasion someone died?
Yep.
What did the police do? What did the custodial officers do? The commission got broadened out to a national commission in all the jurisdictions. And there were 99 deaths that had occurred between the period of the Royal Commission's inquiry. But the brilliance of the commission, I think, with Elliot Johnson taking over from Justice Muirhead, and Elliot was a renowned jurist from South Australia, very, 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 very good man. And so were the other commissioners, Lou Wyville and Hal Wooten, the late Dan O'Day, and people of that ilk. But they then saw that it's the underlying factors. What is it that's enabling or causes Aboriginal people to come to the attention of the police in the first instance? And that was about health, housing, education, employment, and all the matters that we know of today, overcrowding, etc. And so it was out of that concern to look at the underlying issues that Elliot Johnson negotiated with Peter Dowding, who was the Premier of Western Australia at the time, for a specific position to be created in the commission and approached me about filling that position. So I became a commissioner that was primarily charged with looking at the underlying issues in Western Australia, and not to inquire into the deaths per se, but to look at why is it that someone is, in these circumstances, coming into the attention of the police, to the courts, then ending up in custody, and what happens when they're in custody, whether it's a prison or whether it's a jail cell.
Yeah.
So the commission saw that this wasn't just about the criminal justice system itself, wasn't about the police themselves or the custodial officers. It was about their duties. How do they behave in line with their responsibilities and the care that they need to take when they have people in custody? So the police obviously aren't doctors, they're not nurses, they're not well equipped for custodial duties even. That's why we have prisons. And so the encounter that the police often have is someone at their worst, normally at their worst conditions as a human being. Not always, but normally at their worst position. But they don't understand the underlying issues of that person's disposition, whether they've got a heart problem or some other medical condition, or mental health issues. And a lot of mental health now we've become more aware of through FASD. And kids, young people being incarcerated because of they've done the crime, but their mental capacity to make the pleas are diminished.
Yeah.
So we have more people going into custody rather than to medical care because they've committed, technically committed a crime, not able to make a plea, then they're held for at the pleasure of governors, basically, to release them.
Yeah.
So the criminal justice system is not the answer to the awful social conditions that people find themselves in. So the governments have had 339 recommendations from that commission. Most of them are about what to do in the social space, some about the criminal justice system and how it could operate. For instance, custody should be a last resort. You know, it's taken some time for that to perpetrate, and that notifications for people when they're taken into custody should take place, and that there should be Aboriginal people appointed to be contacted or to come into the prisons or the cells when someone's in a state, so that there's someone other than a uniformed person they can discuss. And that worked for a while. You had what they call the visitor scheme.
Mm-hmm.
was a good scheme to act as a neutral person that could provide advice to the authorities and help, I suppose, educate officers and others on the job as to why someone may be behaving in the way that they do.
Yeah.
Because most officers have come from overseas. I found in Western Australia, I think most people had come from the Black Watch, the Scottish Black Watch.
Really?
They're custodial officers. They were people that had only been in the country for less than 6 years or so. So their backgrounds in terms of Australian history and the relationship of governments to Aboriginal people was very limited in many ways.
Right.
So they imported a lot of people out of South Africa and people out of Zimbabwe. You know, so the custodial, this is not to condemn those people, it's just to say that their cultural prisms through which they saw First Nations peoples was pretty clouded.
Yeah.
And even the best of them were frustrated because they didn't know how to deal in the situations that they were given responsibility for.
So, I mean, so is the bottom line, like expressing this in the simplest terms, is the bottom line that Indigenous people die in custody because, well, there's a whole chain sitting behind that. They come to the attention of police more quickly, they're charged more frequently, they're held more frequently, therefore this is why you get whatever we're up to now, some dreadful number, over 400 deaths in custody. Is that it, or is there something about this I don't get, Pat?
No, I think that's certainly a big part of it. People become institutionalised into the process, but also their underlying health conditions aren't being addressed. The prison mental health provisions are not so great. They're not resourced sufficiently. The record shifting between the prisons and, you know, medical service isn't always that great. So the knowledge of an individual's personal records aren't always readily available to the, particularly the custodial people. There's all sorts of confidentiality things about that. But and if people have got no hope, if people find themselves under surveillance constantly because, the police will come to them because they did 6 months a couple of years ago or a year ago, and then they start getting accused and they feel that there's no exit out of the revolving door system, and they just go from prisons, jailhouses to prisons and courts. So deaths in custody, and police have got to learn, I think, to have the incarceration should be the last resort. Take people to hospitals or to clinics, and clinics have got to learn, because there have been a lot of deaths in those situations as well whilst they're in custody, that hospitals and clinics have got to learn about how to behave or how to respond in those situations as well. And of course, you're dealing with people who could be violent, they could be under drugs, they could be under all sorts of medical, health issues. And you've got to be able to deal with that. And medical people are the best people to deal with. They're not a police officer. They'll use force.
What about, and you may think that this is a distinction without a difference, and if you do, tell me, Ryan, but do you think that, with the obvious caveat, not all police, not all custodial officers, but do you think there is institutional racism in the police force, in the sort of among the ranks of custodial officers, or is it just a lack of empathy, a lack of cultural acuity? What is it, do you think?
It's a good question. It's a good question because, there are good police and there are good custodial people and there are a lot of good people in the society. But there is this disproportionate incarceration rate. Mm. And you can ask yourself, why is that? And that's possibly because the amount of training the police get is very small. So probably an hour of their total training period. Most of them probably have never read the Royal Commission recommendations, let alone the report. And they don't get to have extensive education about that. You know, they might be given something primarily to protect themselves,
yes,
yeah, rather than to understand the kind of people that they're dealing with.
Yeah.
And so the interface between police, and that's why part of the Royal Commission was to say to the police officers in the regional areas who had authority to set up the reference groups where they could have the discussions with local community people and talk about what might happen or what could be done or how to do things at the regional level in certain situations prior to crises arising.
Yeah.
And then that would help the police execute their duties with the kind of social license and understanding that a community needs to have.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just seen as an authoritarian approach coming in to stand over. And that always leads to fear and obviously the attributing of the worst motives to authorities.
So a bit of both, maybe some racism, maybe some just lack of comprehension, lack of understanding, lack of cross-cultural understanding, for want of a better term.
Yeah, and police are trained, you know, they're trained people, so, and they're trained to assert authority. And anyone that's going to give them lip or defy them in any way, they're going to assert authority.
Mm.
And that's usually physical.
Mm.
And then they're usually protected because of that. So they're not trained to be psychoanalyzing people, you know. Mm. They're not trained to sit down and have a cup of tea and talk to someone.
Mm.
They're not trained to observe body language in a way that enables them to work out a better way to communicate. So there are many things about their training and their equipping that should be attended to, and not just for aggressive responses or the use of tasers or other sorts of, you know, shoot-to-kill kind of behaviours, which we've seen, unfortunately, creeping into the policing service in recent days.
Mm. Let's go to the protests.
Loud and proud now, people! Black Lives Matter!
Black Lives Matter!
Everyone! Black Lives Matter!
It's been big news, and the Prime Minister's decided to rev things up about the legitimacy of the protests.
Come on, people! Always was! Aboriginal land! Always was!
It's an important issue. But when it comes to the issue of gatherings and protests, the health advice says it put other Australians' lives at risk, including in particular Indigenous lives.
What do you think about that? Because obviously there's protests and there's a public, you know, there's a pandemic. What do you reckon?
Well, there are several agendas that are running, and there's huge risks. I went on, sending out a message to the communities early in the pandemic, saying stay at home, don't bother going to visit family and communities, etc. Let's put all of that off until next year. And that this is a dangerous thing.
Mm.
It has no friends and it will kill you.
Yeah.
And so I'm on the record of saying that. So when it came to the protests, there's no winners in this argument. There's no winners here because people are so frustrated. This is 30 years on from the Royal Commission that made 339 recommendations, a lot of them in the social space, health, housing, education, etc., and as well as better ways to behave in the policing service, notifications rather than imprisonment, etc., or arrests.
Mm.
So people are frustrated and they have seen very little action. It's only recently we've seen a few police being charged and the fellow at UNAMU charged with murder. But we've seen some awful deaths. A man basically fried to death in the back of a prison van in Western Australia.
Of an Aboriginal elder. Mr Ward died of heat stroke after being driven across the goldfields in a prison van in 2008.
The awful treatment of a young lady in the lockup at Port Hedland.
Today, Ms Dew died 2 days after being locked up at South Hedland Police Station for the non-payment of fines.
The lady on the train in Victoria.
Tanya Day was taken into custody after she fell asleep on a train in regional Victoria in December 2017. She died in hospital 17 days later.
So there's a These are the appalling things that people see. They don't often see the good things that police do or custodial people do. But it's the lack of action about those sorts of issues where if you and I assaulted someone, we'd be charged and we'd be brought before the court straight up. Seems to be an immunity for the police. You want the police to carry out the law and protect citizens. But on the other hand, they have a high duty to deal with the citizens in a way that, you know, accords people as much respect as you can. Mm. And we probably haven't developed an environmental or an employment set of conditions that articulates the duty of care very clearly to policing officers. They've got guidelines and protocols and books that tell them about things. But they've got to be held accountable to standards by independent authority.
Yeah. So people are frustrated because police seem a law unto themselves, right? Like paraphrasing right? So the frustration builds. George Floyd dies at the hand of police in the States. Massive international focus and consciousness spills into the Australian political system and people hit the streets. But should they have done that or shouldn't they have done that?
Well, I can't say what people should do or shouldn't do. I mean, I think a lot of people have been patient. They've set up committees, they've had discussions, they've even joined the police forces, they've become lawyers, they're at the bar, they're trying to argue cases, etc. So, and yet we still see a systemic set of behaviours in certain circumstances which just triggers the most awful recollections of our interconnected history. And that's the problem we've got, that we've got to have a truth-telling, and that's the thing we're seeing now with the protesters. I'm not sure whether the pulling down of statues of, you know, racist individuals is going to answer that particular concern. But, I was minded in recent days to go back and read Steve Biko, I Write What I Like, was a book he wrote, and he was the leader of a black consciousness movement in South Africa prior to apartheid being lifted and was killed by police, ultimately, a young man. But his definition of racism was discrimination by one group of people against another group of people for the purpose of subjugation. Now, none of that's about colour. That's about power, and it's about capacity, influence, status. And if you're constantly doing that, you're constantly subjugating, as I've seen with the First Nations peoples, then it's you're going to get reaction. And the risk-taking against the virus, I think, was relativised. So people decided that because of extended family connections and loyalties, if they're going to get the virus, and then, you know, they'll die just as much as the person they love that they're protesting on the streets about. So I think the fear for those who live in comfort is that they themselves might find the spike, you know, getting worse, and therefore the infringement upon their liberties and freedoms being curtailed even more. And so it's a difficult conundrum. You know, a lot of Aboriginal people got wiped out in the Spanish flu. Whenever there's a lot of us got wiped out initially. With the viruses that were imported when the white folks came here.
Yeah.
So, and if there's been no improvement to our situations in the last 200 years, in a sense, particularly in this criminal justice space where we could do things, and we've, you know, got recommendations to guide us about that, and then this, you can't argue states and commonwealths who can come together around the virus, why can't they come together around this particular crisis? Mm. And find avenues to solve it.
Well, answer your question. Why?
Well, partly it's money. Partly it's ideology. And partly it's you win votes by being hard on crime. So you sacrifice the integrity of the nation for short-term gains rather than try to resolve this through responding positively to things like the Uluru Statement, you know, the voice from the heart, where people have said, you know, understand the tyranny of our powerlessness We want a voice to the parliament to talk about these things, to inform you when you're doing the wrong thing in a constructive, democratic way. And we want that entrenched in the constitution. We want truth to be told, not just about our intertwined history, but about the history of the First Nations peoples themselves, the uniqueness of why our lands are important, why sacred sites are important, why kinship structures are important, so that you might understand why in the modernised livings that we've got, we're going to respond in a certain way. You do damage a site, we're going to respond, because you should understand our religious and cultural beliefs in relation to these things. If you affect our family in a certain way, you know we're going to respond. You know, so it's not a lack of knowledge here. It's the persistence of the desire to subjugate Aboriginal people because you can.
And do you think that explains the Prime Minister's comments about the protests? He's taken a while to come off the long run about the protests. He's in a mode, we've all seen, a mode of leadership of leading in a crisis, of bringing the country together. I think quite genuinely he has been in that mode. Certainly we've had Matthias Cormann saying, you know, the protests are terrible. What about all the people who couldn't go to, you know, their parents' funeral or whatever else? We've had Scott Morrison saying similar things in a couple of radio interviews this week, sort of revving up the divisions. What's that about?
Well, it's a denial of our own institutions. I mean, the people in Sydney went to court and they sought, you know, as we do, we go to the courts and we get a ruling. There were two instances where one judge ruled it out and the other judge ruled it in. And so they felt legitimised in what their actions were going to be. In other places, there were varying views from medical people. And we're getting differing views from, you know, the football crowd that want to see crowds at the football games. They're gradually lifting activities around pubs and, you know, funerals and weddings and so forth. So it's a bit hard, and we're getting indicators to tell us that the virus, you know, we haven't had a case in the last day or so. So it's a bit confusing, I think, for a lot of punters to know what's safe and not safe. And then when you feel as though you've been denied the opportunity to meet your obligations to your mother or someone that whose birthday it was and you couldn't go, and then you've got to be resentful of what people seem to be able to do without any penalty associated with it. So it is a bit confusing. I wouldn't condemn people's motives. I think people took great risks, and that's their personal risk factor. We'll know in a few weeks' time whether there are family members that have contracted the virus, and that'll be sad if that's happened. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are putting themselves at risk every day of the week to keep us all safe. And we do praise them, we acknowledge them, we recognise them. And no one wants to see this thing spread anymore or any more deaths to occur. But if you don't stop the causes that are giving rise to the levels of custody, and you don't stop the deaths in custody, you don't stop the causes for why you need to take 30,000, you know, Aboriginal kids and put them in out-of-home care, if you don't deal with these things, you're basically on a track to some form of genocide. And if you're confronting genocide as opposed to contracting a virus by protesting, you know, I think people are going to make some decisions that are going to be on the basis of going to the protests.
Mm. You've seen a lot of prime ministers now, obviously, in your time.
I think Menzies was the first.
Well, well, you've seen a few,
I don't know,
right?
If people remember him, the Libs do. Well,
but it's sort of, I'm just sort of interested, right, in this. It's subjugation, it's paternalism, it's, you know, this is why this conversation matters, because you then can express how it feels to be a First Nations person on the receiving end of all of this helpful advice, right, over 50 years. But Morrison, what do you think about him? He started early in his prime ministership, obviously being reasonably forward-leaning on recognition, for example, and then has pulled right back. Where do you think he's going to sit in terms of a prime minister who does something or does nothing in this area?
Well, he and his First Nations minister could go down in history as doing some great things. You know, if they actually brought a bill into the parliament that set up the voice with regional authorities or place-based decision-making and empowered Aboriginal peoples at those levels and had states locked into an agreement around that. And if he was to, you know, embark and encourage the truth-telling process and the Makarrata process. And in fact, if he sat down and started to think of how best to prepare the nation for a treaty or agreement-making process. Now, that mightn't take place in his lifetime, but if he lays the foundation and show that there's an openness towards that and that that's part of the resolution and healing of the wounds that gives rise to people going mad sometimes, then that would be a great level of leadership. I don't know why he's reticent about that. Politically, yes, he's got some people there on the hard right who think mangoes shouldn't grow on trees. But, you know, there's a from a national perspective, as a statesman perspective, we've had some really, leaders who've been prepared to step outside of their party comfort zones and actually indicate a direction for the nation. And we're in those times now. We're in those times not only because we need our economy back on its foot, but we need a new social compact, as it were, a new agreement with First Nations peoples about their position within the nation as we go forward. Mm. And the ingredients are there. There's the Reform Council that's going to be set up. The First Nations are represented through organisational entities, but they've got to be given better status than that. And there's a capacity to bring bills in and pass laws as quickly as possible with the collaboration of the Labor Party and the crossbenchers on many of these things. So it just takes the leadership of the Prime Minister to wake up one morning and say, yes, Captain Cook sailed in here, but he's wrecked some, his consequences or the consequences of that colonisation process is what we've been grappling with for the last 200 years, and it's time that we tied the ship up and reformed that legacy in a way that gives pride to all of us.
You think he'll do it or not?
I would hope he does it. I seriously...
What does your gut tell you, Pat?
My gut tells me he's not going to do it. But he can come from left field at different times.
Mm.
And I think if his minister is a bit more forthright, then he may get there. And then if he listens to the peak organisations, he may get there. I think the connectivity between issues is the problem he's got. And the solution to that connectivity is, I think, pretty clearly articulated in the Uluru Statement as to the way forward here.
Mm. Last question. So just again on the protests and Morrison, we saw some protests, much smaller protests a few weeks ago about conspiracy theories, 5G, and Bill Gates was spreading COVID into the universe, or I don't entirely follow some of the logic. Those protests were okay. Those protests were, stuff happens in a democracy. Black Lives Matter protests in a different category. Why?
Because he can't control it. He would have to make a decision about these more systemic issues. He has to make a decision about the voice of the parliament. He has to make a decision about that being entrenched constitutionally. And he has to make a decision about the Makarrata type commission, truth-telling and agreement-making. Now, he has no clear line of sight as to where any of that might go. And that's what he's fearful of, losing control of a process that actually requires dialogue, discourse and negotiation, which he isn't in command of.
Mm, interesting. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate the time in the middle of the busy sitting week. Thank you, as always, to my executive producer, Miles Martignoni, for pulling the show together. Thank you to you guys for listening. Thank you to you guys for sharing it and talking about it and posting it on your social media sites. We really do appreciate it. We'll be back next week.
Thanks very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.